testimony. We're going to go into a work session on House Bill 3508. And I have invited testimony. And Jane Myers, would you come and give us this testimony?
You dropped something, Jane.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We're in support of House Bill 3508, and I think at the public hearing a question arose about different numbers that were presented to the committee about the exposure on dental x-rays versus the exposure on other kinds of x-rays. So after several conversations with experts in the field, On the copy that you have in front of you, I just want to explain to you what those differences are. First, you have a conversion because the American Dental Association's table is in millisieverts, while the Health Division information was in millirems. And so in order to make it easier to understand, we've converted it. First, you have the Health Division information. And then the American Dental Association's website information. And I've just taken the bite wings, which are the dental x-rays, versus chest and abdomen. I don't know in the Health Division's information if that was lower or upper. But for the sake of argument, you can see the exposures are still somewhat different, but a little bit closer at the side of the table where you convert them to millirems. OHSU explains the difference to me this way. And this is from Dr. Doug Barnett, who's the head of dental radiology at OHSU School of Dentistry. He teaches oral radiology, and he says radiation biologists would not use skin entrance as the means of comparing exposures, which is what the Health Division did. It uses skin entrance exposures for comparison purposes. So what he says is skin entrance exposure, and this is a direct quote, doesn't tell you what surface is being exposed, the area of the surface being exposed, how much is being absorbed by the patient and the critical organs exposed. For instance, the exposure of bone marrow tissue is important to determine the exposure on a chest film. The one that causes the biological effect to the patient is the one that's looked at, not the skin entrance exposure. Dr. Barnett also said that no one he knows in the field uses skin entrance dose as the measurement of harmful effect, which is the measurement that is used so that you would be comparing apples to apples. I've given you a quote from the textbook that they use to teach the dental students in this area. I don't know if you want me to go into reading that. It kind of explains the table, which is also attached here. But this is the source, and it's interesting that they say if you use this calculation, okay, maybe I should back up a little bit, because they're saying it's tempting to make a direct comparison of the previously discussed values for risk estimation. I've given your committee clerk the entire chapter from this book that was sent to me, but it's like 24 pages long, and if you want to check it with her, I've got it. However, the statement that a single dental periapical radiograph delivers more than 10 times the radiation of a chest film in terms of surface exposure, 217 versus 16 millirems, is not entirely true because of the differences in the exposed area and critical organs. These differences may be compensated for by a calculation of the E, which is the estimate of the uniform whole body exposure carrying the same probability of radiation effect as partial body exposure. By this method of calculation, a complete mouth survey of 20 dental films made by methods that were optimized for dose, which is you would use the fast, this is e-speed film, which is a fast film, collimation, which means that you shut the beam down to a very limited area, has been found to deliver less than half the amount of radiation of a single chest x-ray. That's 20 dental films, half of the amount of radiation of a single chest x-ray, and less than 1% of the amount of a barium study of the intestines. Now, that's the source that is being used to teach dental students about radiology today. the table in the oral radiology test that you have showing the effective dose measurements for the various exams shows 20 dental films at 1.7 millirems, and a chest x-ray is 8 millirems. Dr. Burnett said the Health Division's numbers would be the worst-case scenario, assuming the use of the darkest film and kilovolt settings that are not being used and are certainly not optimum. Dr. Fred Sorensen, another dentist who until recently served on the Health Services Advisory Committee on Radiation Protection, agreed that the argument made by the Health Service on House Bill 3508 was not a apples-to-apples comparison and deferred to Dr. Barnett, who replaced Dr. Sorensen teaching oral radiology at OHSU. So I hope if you have any questions, I can try to answer them.
Yeah, I think you pretty well answered the questions, and that makes a lot more sense when you convert to the same measurement. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're in work session, and
Mr.
I would.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to hear the Health Division's reaction to this, if anybody's here from there.
Well,
there's a huge discrepancy in this, and
that was exactly what we figured, and I think this explains it pretty thoroughly. You convert it over from the measurements that they were using into the measurements that are qualified and the same on both sides, and you've got a situation that makes sense.
Well, then I don't know what to say about that. I mean, we haven't heard what the Health Division thinks about Dr. Barnett's analysis. I mean, this is complicated stuff. I can't say I still fully understand it.
Well, I don't know that I'm going to stick around this afternoon long enough that all of our committee understands all the theory of X-ray and stuff thoroughly, but it's converted here. You got the chart right in front of yourself of what the Health Division said and what was presented by them and what the American Dental Website Association does when it's converted over to the same measurements, and it's not too hard to see that you've got just about the same comparison of the amount of the 20 films up there would be about probably one-eighth of approximately of what a chest x-ray would be. In area, and so you've got it pretty well established that you're getting about the same thing per area that you're getting, not 10 to 30 times more in a
Mr. Chair.
X-ray. Yes,
Brown. Do you think it's appropriate for the Health Division to come up and respond to the testimony that was presented?
You want to be able to come back?
Well, then you don't bring up the proponents.
You're pushed to get out of here now. Grant, you wish to?
Gail.
Gail?
Mr. Chair, as one who is leaning toward voting yes, I do appreciate hearing Gail's response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gail Stibley, Administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems for DHS, State of Oregon. I will be brief. You're absolutely right, Senator Burdick. This is complicated stuff, and I appreciate your wanting to get at least some additional information to make a very considered opinion. Specific to the point, we're still somewhat comparing apples and oranges. Clearly, we can do mathematical translations between millisieverts, microsieverts, and millirems. What continues to be different is external skin exposure versus calculated whole body exposure to unspecified internal organs of interest. That is, clearly, if you're taking a chest x-ray, the internal organ of interest won't be your thyroid, it would be your lungs. If you're taking an adult bite wing, it would be your thyroid, presumably, and so on. Those are unspecified on the website, but I would imagine that we could, you know, probably divine fairly accurately what those are. We also clearly have, as often, are in contact with the Oregon Dental Association, and at Ms. Meyer's urging, and took the faxed copy of what she had sent, which we appreciated very much. It is this Oral Radiology Principles and Interpretation from OHSU. It's the fourth edition. Stuart White and Michael Farrell. We actually then went to OHSU to check the book out, and this is the same book, although the font is different, also fourth edition, etc. What we found interesting, and unfortunately I just learned this morning looking at this, on page 49, I don't know if that's included in the handouts that you have or not, in terms of, she mentioned the table, so I thought perhaps she had that, in terms of effective dose, equivalent natural exposure, etc. This again has to do with effective whole body, calculated effective whole body doses to an internal organ, which of course has to be calculated because everybody's bone density, body fat, different tissue cells are different in different parts of the body. Epithelial cells absorb at different rates than other tissue cells in other parts of the body, etc. But one thing that I found interesting was that even these numbers are very different from each other, and frankly, I can't explain that. And so at the risk of adding yet another question mark to this, I would be remiss if I didn't share that. They both have to do with e-speed, rectangular columnation, complete mouse survey, 20 films. One has a microsievert of 33. That's the book that we checked out. And this one has a microsievert exposure or effective dose of 17. And yet, so one is double than the other. So clearly, even the books disagree with each other, and it's the same book, same edition.
But so I don't disagree that the chest X-ray is a whole lot more than the dental X-ray.
Well, what we have from standard exposure values, and we have this also converted from millirems to millisieverts to ADA estimated exposure in millisieverts. For example, intraoral film in millisieverts is 2.24. AP lumbar spine is 3.7. Cervical spine AP is 0.95. Skull lateral is 0.75. I can certainly supply the committee with this. At any rate, I also, again, at Ms. Meyer's urging, had a conversation with Dr. Sorensen, a terrific gentleman who has been very involved for many years, is retired now. He also expressed to me that, again, clarifying that one is kind of the difference between basic science versus applied science. One is the amount of exposure to the skin, and the other is a calculated equivalent whole body exposure to a specified organ of interest. And if and when the X-rays are done properly, his term, then and clearly everything is safe, appropriate, clearly within public health guidelines. And he also stated that ESEs, or entrance skin exposures, are much easier to measure that level. It does not tell you, of course, how much is absorbed, where it's absorbed, and any resulting impact or consequence to a specific organ. So I draw the committee's attention to that. Last but not least, I will also share with you, as I think I alluded to before but didn't specify, that this frankly would be a precedent-setting piece of public policy in terms of how the public health authority in the state deals with medical licensing and certification boards. We deal with the Board of Veterinary, the Board of Radiologic Technicians, podiatrists, chiropractors, and so on. They would all continue to be run and organized and coordinated the same way. This would be the same.
Yeah, we went through that last time and hashed that out pretty well, and we understand that we're departing a little bit from past procedure, and I guess probably because there's a certain feeling, and at least with some reason to listen to it of unreasonable treatment, basically, in the process of doing your licensing. And a failure on part of your group to answer some of those things. And that's, I guess, where we're at more than anything else.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your candor. I will share with you that, again, clarifying, we don't do the licensing. The Oregon Board of Dentistry does the licensing, as all the other health boards do. A component of their training requirement is radiation safety training. We work with the board, as we do with all the other boards, to make sure that the amount of training and the types of training and the avenues of training are appropriate for that particular application.
And I guess it's a matter of semantics. They have to meet your requirements. Basically, you're controlling the licensing process, whether it's them issuing the license or you issuing the license. And this is a bone of contention.
I appreciate
Senator Brown.
That. Sure.
Thanks. Quick question, and then I have an email from a dentist who says that under this bill, dental assistants would gain access to their x-ray credentials easier than dentists or hygienists. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's exactly correct.
Okay. Thank you.
As long as we're taking a minute, Representative Anderson, do you wish to?
Mr. Chair, if I may, you mentioned in terms of the communication or relationship between this regulated entity and the department. Clearly, there is always improvement to be done. I will share with you, since I came on board the end of February, in the first 90 days that I was on, I was responsible, I signed off on rules reducing the number of radiation safety hours by 25% for dental assistants. We are in the final throes of approving a web-based distance learning module for dental assistants in radiation safety training that the Oregon Dental Association wanted. And we are maybe a third of the way through discussions about changing or modifying the way that we provide that sort of training, didactic versus practical type of radiation safety training. So I certainly can't speak to something that happened a decade ago or even 5 years ago, but I will tell you in the last 90 days there's been a lot happening.
Thank you. I would entertain a motion for House Bill 3508.
Senator, Mr. Chair.
Senator Claro.
I would move House Bill 3508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Claro moves House Bill 3508 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections?
All right, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I would as well, Mr. Chair.
Will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Burdick.
No.
Senator Claro.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill. I'm now going to close the work session on House Bill 3508, and I will open a work session on House Bill 3609.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3609 directs the Department of Human Services to establish 3 pilot programs to assist veterans, their spouses, or dependents in applying for veterans' benefits, and it sunsets the pilot programs on January 2nd of 2006. We did have an initial public hearing on the 14th of May. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and you also have the -3 amendment that came from Representative Gallegos.
Okay. We have Frank Fryer here, and we've asked him to come. He got cut out the last time when we were due to the having us have to escape the building or the room here. Okay. And so we would like to have you put your testimony on record and give you an opportunity to speak for the veterans.
Thank you, Senator Fisher, Chair, and other members of the committee. Yeah, I'm here in support of the bill, with any amendment also. Primarily, I wanted to come and clarify if there were any questions that the committee had about prior testimony, the effect of the bill, why it's a needed bill. As the Director Mangus stated last time, Oregon revised statutes already allow county veteran service officers to do some of the things that are foreseen in this bill. The problem is there's no funding for most county veteran service officers to do the comprehensive type of screening and casework to receive the results that this bill seeks to achieve. In the pilot project, the bill was not cost neutral, it would actually save the state general fund dollars. The expansion of the bill is intended to save the state even more general fund dollars, at the same time bringing more money into the state from the Federal Veterans Administration in lieu of state and federal Medicaid funds. The bill does not ask us to go out and search throughout the state for people just to take care of the people who are already in the Medicaid system or will soon be in the Medicaid system. When people come into the Medicaid case managers, this program will allow them to immediately send those people to the Veterans Service Officer to start the obtaining of federal veterans benefits, thereby saving the state not only the Medicaid funds, but the work involved in getting those people onto Medicaid. That's all I wanted to say, and I could be glad to answer any questions.
I'm glad you got an opportunity to come down here, and I apologize again for having you to have to make an extra trip here, and appreciate your work on behalf of the veterans. So thank you for your testimony. I think a lot of the committee here shares your feeling that the state could save some money and also help out our veterans at the same time with the initiation of these pilot projects here. So,
thank you, Senator.
Thank you much. Were there questions of Frank? Thank you very much for helping us out here on that. We are in work session, and we have an amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morissette.
I would move House Bill 3609 as amended. Dash 3 amendment. Okay, I would move the dash 3 amendments. I'm sorry. To 3609.
Okay. Senator Morissette moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3609. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Objections? Will clerk call roll?
Senator Brown.
Senator Brown's excused and Senator Carno's excused.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Chair Bishop.
Aye. Motion carries.
Okay, I would move House Bill 3609 as amended to the floor. Ways and Means. Okay. Two ways.
We are going to... Wait a minute. This is an escort. I'm sorry. We got one here later on. We want to take the Ways and Means reference off of.
So this will go to Ways.
Yes.
Okay. So I would move House Bill 3609 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves House Bill 3609 as amended by the dash 3 amendments to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. The motion carries, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3609 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2120. Yeah, we have Janet Carlson here. Do you have folks you wish to bring up with you? That's fine. That clears our testimony agenda. So
yeah, we'll just all be together.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. House Bill 2120 came out of the
Representative Cruz's House Human Resources Committee. It's a bill that deals with local coordinated comprehensive plans for children and families. As you know, the legislature in the last 10 years has done a lot of work with regard to children and families and trying to coordinate planning and services at the community level so that we strengthen families and prevent problems in the future. House Bill 2120 brings public health and mental health into the fold of the list of plans that are named in what was Senate Bill 555 in 1999 for coordinated comprehensive planning. Representative Cruz asked us to create a work group, which we did, and met, I think, three work group sessions and then a fourth session with some of the key representatives from each of the various agencies and organizations to come to agreement. What you have before you is the consensus of the Department of Human Services, the Association of Oregon Counties, the State Commission on Children and Families, CLO, health officials and mental health officials as well, about what this what the language ought to be. The single page that you have outlines the agreements of the work group. That the bill now clarifies the distinction between a broader community plan and the various service plans, that the service plans are attached to the community plans and encourage the plans to be integrated under 19 high-level outcomes. The intent is no additional planning efforts for mental health, public health, or local commissions on children and families. In a separate effort, and it didn't become a bill, Department of Human Services offered to do this administratively. Five separate behavioral health plans will be pulled together into one behavioral health plan. There was a lot of fact-finding that went on in the work group. We identified a number of existing planning processes and gathered a lot of information. You see that on your handout. I won't take the time to read that to you. The other thing that's not on your handout is that the approval processes in the prior statute were clarified by this bill, and it's specified that the State Commission on Children and Families does not approve the various service plans. You'll see I drew you a picture that's on the front of the larger packet that shows you the relationship between the community plan and the service plans and the various entities that actually review and or approve the plans. And the House Bill 2120 plans are at the bottom, public health and mental health. The bill was placed on the consent calendar in the House, and it has no fiscal or no revenue impact. And I think as Senator Fisher mentioned, the Ways and Means leadership and Senate leadership have approved rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Anyway, that's my understanding. So with that, I'll let others testify and open it to questions.
Thank you, Janet.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Donna Middleton, the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. We're here today in support of House Bill 2120. We were part of the work group that Janet mentioned. I want to also state that in many, many counties, and Douglas County being one of them, because Senator Fisher told me that he's seen a marked difference in the way people are planning and working together in Douglas County, that public health and mental health and a number of communities are already at the table. All this bill does is clarify that we want them to be at the table, we want them to participate in the system of support for children and families, and this just makes sure that we have them included in the process. And so just wanted to let you know that they have our full support at the Commission on Children and Families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz, Association of Oregon Counties. We, too, were part of the work group. We're pleased with the results of this. Primarily, we're concerned about the additional workload that might be placed on a service system that was already has experienced some devastated cuts. This bill allows for us to take the plan that we already do in public health and mental health and attach it to the community plan, and at some point, if there's ever resources, try to put those plans together. So from that standpoint, we're very pleased with that piece of it and the other pieces that have been outlined. So we're supportive as well.
Questions? Thank you very much. I will close. Does anyone else wish to give testimony on this bill? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2120 and entertain a motion to.
Senator Morzette. We, well, rescind the referral to Ways and Means and send House Bill 2120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette has moved that we request the leadership to rescind the reference to sending the bill to Ways and Means, and that we pass House Bill 2120 to the House floor, Senate floor, with a due pass recommendation. Is there a further? Yes, Senator Starr.
That's without amendment, isn't it?
Without amendment.
Yeah, we don't have any amendments for it.
Sorry about that.
No, it wasn't.
Any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Burney.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. The motion carries, and again, we have Senators Brown and Clarno excused. We need a carrier.
I'll be happy.
All right, Senator Morissette, we'd be glad to have you do that. Senator Morissette will be the carrier, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2120 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2165.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2165 requires certain organizations to report information concerning conduct of physicians to the Board of Medical Examiners. It requires licensees to self-report certain conduct to the board and defines official action, incident, or events. Changes language from physician to licensee, establishes 10 working days reporting timeline for self-reporting and 10 business days for healthcare facilities to report. We just received the Dash A5 amendment that I believe Bruce Bishop will probably address in his testimony.
All right.
And speaking of, Richard's registration here.
Thank you. Kathleen Haley and Bruce Bishop. And Scott.
Yeah,
I'm just
chairman. I'm
Bobby Garn. I don't want anybody, how should I say, edging in on my domain here as bodyguard. Go ahead. I don't know who wants to speak first.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And I'm here in support of House Bill 2165A. The board believes that the cornerstone of patient safety is a professional, impartial medical board. And in order to do its job, the board needs the best information available to fulfill its statutory mandate to protect the public. And hospitals are one of the best sources of information on problem physicians. And hospitals have been inconsistently reporting to the board. And when asked why, a couple of the reasons are that there was no timeline in the existing statute, and also there was a question about what to report. As a result of that, the board put forth 2165. The A engrossed bill before the committee is a little bit different from the originally introduced bill and reflects weeks of discussion between the board, the medical association, and the hospital association. And as a result of these discussions, the House of Representatives further refined what needs to be reported to the board and also directs the board to draft administrative rules defining medical incompetence, unprofessional conduct, and licensee impairment. The bill requires that official actions, incidents, or events be reported to the board, and this bill defines what those are. It also requires that the reports be made to the board within 10 working days. The House also, as I mentioned earlier, amended the original bill to have the board write the rules and also allowed for immunity for those who report to the board, immunity from civil action for those who report to the board in good faith. Based upon our work on this bill, I request your approval of the bill and thank you for the opportunity to present testimony, and I can answer any questions you might have.
I guess I have a question here because the proposed amendments work on page 4, and it says after 3. I don't have a... Oh, okay. I see. I was looking for the vertical 3, 4, and 5 instead of a horizontal 3, 4, and 5. I apologize.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and we are in agreement with what Ms. Haley has testified about the improvements to House Bill 2165 over current law. The bill is about 99.99% there. We would like to request that the committee consider the A5 amendments that makes clear that a hospital or a self-report would not be the sole basis for a claim of incompetence by a physician under the physician-assisted suicide law. It is a very small technical amendment that we think clarifies the reporting requirements. We would urge the committee to adopt the A5 amendments and to move the bill through the process, because we think the bill does make important improvements in the current law in terms of reporting requirements for hospitals, physicians, and other persons. I would be glad to answer any questions about those amendments as well.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have these ORS 677.415. What are subsections 4 and 5 under that we're including in this statute?
Senator Fisher, Senator Burdick, those are in the bill. Those are section 1 of the bill. So if you look on page 2, the bill adds in lines 4 through 8 the self-reporting requirements and then the hospital reporting requirements. All we're doing is making sure that those provisions are incorporated into section 3 in the immunity section, so that there's no so that everybody is clear that those reports as well don't subject somebody to unprofessional conduct.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, I can be very brief. We support the underlying bill. We support the amendments. We believe that it's good policy, and we would encourage the committee to adopt the amendments and move the bill. Thank you.
Further questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill? Get my number straight here. 2165. Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2165.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2165.
Senator Morissette moves the dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2165. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2165 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves House Bill 2165 to the Senate floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? None. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. The motion carries, and again we have Senators Brown and Clarno excused. We have a carrier. Senator Burdick will carry House Bill 2165. It's nice to have an argument over who's going to carry the bill. I like volunteers. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2165 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2251.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2251 authorizes the governor to proclaim a state of impending public health crisis under certain circumstances and allows the governor to seek assistance under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact during the state of impending public health crisis and a variety of other things that I'm sure that Dr. Higginson can address.
All right, and we have Dr. Grant Higginson and Scott Gallant to help us out. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to for the department in support of the A. Gross version of House Bill 2251. After the attacks on September 11th and 2001 and the anthrax attacks that followed after that, one thing that became real clear was that the current laws that we had in place did not adequately protect the citizens of this country or the citizens of Oregon. And so there's a lot of work done both at the state level and at the national level to address that. Here in the state of Oregon, the Attorney General's office did a major review with agency heads of the current existing statutes and compared those with where we thought we should be. From that work, there were over 250 potential legislative issues that were brought up for consideration. Those were then sifted through, and in discussion with local partners and key state agencies, we came up with what we thought were 15 critical issues. Those 15 critical issues were then parceled out to a variety of different work groups, and four of those were sent to the Health Preparedness Advisory Committee, which is a broad-based committee that we have that advises us on our grants around bioterrorism and public health preparedness. There were four issues that went to the Health Preparedness and Advisory Committee. The first one was licensing, credentialing, and liability. The second one was quarantine and isolation. The third one was access to medical records. And the fourth one was what at the time we called public health alert. The HPAC recommended that all of these issues move forward, and a bill that you heard last month and passed out of this committee, House Bill 2410, dealt with those liability, licensing, and credentialing issues. House Bill 2251A that you have in front of you today deals with the other three issues that we were set out to address. And the basis of House Bill 2251 is that it authorizes the governor to declare a state of impending public health crisis. Now, these would be in situations where a full-blown emergency declaration probably is not warranted, but it would give then the state's public health agencies additional limited authority to impose some public health measures to help deal with that impending crisis. And that is spelled out how a declaration takes place in Section 1 of the bill on page 1 of the bill. If such a declaration of an impending public health crisis were declared, then we would have, like I said, limited new authorities. One is that we would be able to adopt new reporting procedures for health care providers. This is spelled out in Section 2.1A. We'd also be able to create diagnostic and treatment protocols, and this is spelled out in Section 2.1B. We would be able to temporarily restrict the movements of individuals and groups so that we could provide those people with health information and get contact information back from them in return in case we needed to contact them at a future date, and that is spelled out in Section 2.1C and also at the very end of the A. Gross bill on page 11. We would have access to medical records to address strictly the impending public health crisis, and that is spelled out in Section 2.3 on page 2. We would be able to use our existing childhood immunization registry as a mass prophylaxis tracking system, and that is spelled out in Section 5 on page 4. And then finally, we would be able to impose a number of other administrative actions if those actions were approved by the governor. The bill also authorizes us in Section 2.1e to impose civil penalties, which we think are a relatively minor civil penalty of $500 per day. And we believe that these kind of authorities would have been very useful for us during the anthrax attacks. Even though we here in Oregon were not involved, these would have been issues that we could have used at that time. An argument could be made, and actually in the past it has been made, that the governor already has existing emergency powers through the statute 401 to do all of these things already. The reason that we think that this is important is when we looked at the experience on the East Coast, when there were the anthrax events going on and over 30,000 people were being prophylaxed for possible anthrax exposure, at that time the national pharmaceutical stockpile was even activated. However, none of those states declared an emergency. So what we believe is that this is an additional tool that really is the right size tool for the job that needs to be done. I should say that at the first hearing, there was conceptual agreement by a number of parties that this bill was a good bill and should move forward. However, there were a number of questions raised by the Oregon Medical Association, the Association of Oregon Hospitals and Health Systems, and the ACLU, as well as other people. And basically, it revolved around three things. One was that there was a feeling that the impending public health crisis could be declared too easily, that it wasn't really restrictive enough and should only be used in the event that there really is a crisis that is impending. The second issue is that people were concerned that the powers, as were written in the original bill, were simply too sweeping and there were not enough controls. And then finally, particularly the ACLU was afraid that in the areas of isolation and quarantine that there was not enough protection of civil liberties. Consequently, we did pull a work group together that included those three organizations as well as a number of other people, and I believe that the product that you have in front of you clearly represents the work of that work group, but I think it's a consensus document to support as well. And I would also mention that actively involved in that work group was the Office of Emergency Management and the Department of Justice, who also are strongly in support of the bill. So with that, I will close. Thank you for the opportunity to present and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gannett. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. What Dr. Higginson just said is correct. The Medical Association, Hospital Association, worked very vigorously to improve the bill. We believe the Ames-Gross bill, in fact, reflects that. And we support, again, its passage out of this committee into the Senate floor. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Grant, I would certainly hope, having been here and operated in Oregon for some time, when the energy crisis and the gas crunch came up back in 1973, then Governor McCaul issued an order for us to provide all kinds of information to him about the different types of energy and amounts that we needed and all that kind of stuff in that process. When it actually arrived, he was nowhere to be seen, and our week's work basically went to nothing. We received no help, no suggestion of help or anything else in that process. I would certainly hope that we're not setting up something here where we have the requirements for more reporting and receiving data and all that kind of stuff. Those would not be used in a way that would require a week's work and then would not be used for any basically good purpose when the time came that it was needed. And so I would just hope that in the process of the coming months that these would be used in a very adult and mature manner and not as a way to just cause more strife and trouble to people that are already pushed almost to the breaking point to provide our health care and things like that.
Right. Senator Fisher, I you know, echo your concerns and comments. And first, clearly, an impending public health crisis would not be declared unless there was a real reason for it to be declared. And the only reason that we would have additional reporting requirements is if it was something that we thought was either critical to stop the spread of the disease, or it was an issue where we thought it was important to have additional reporting so we could come up with some kind of treatment and diagnostic protocols. And, I mean, a good example is around the anthrax. It would have been very useful to us to have been able to require reporting a pharmacist of how much ciprofloxacin was being distributed to see if there were actual runs of the prophylactic medication going on in the time that there would be a severe shortage of antibiotics like that. That kind of thing would be important for us to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, from the Medical Association's perspective, there were a couple of additions that we thought were very important. One was that the division will use medical experts in the development of protocols that we thought was critical and was missing originally in the bill. And the division graciously added that to the proposal. If one can do anything graciously in the legislative process. And secondarily, in the identification of a medical concern like this, the information that the health division gathers, the bill provides for that information being sent back to the primary care physician so that they are on top of what is happening to their patients in the process. So we think that is a very important, useful tool. And again, you don't have to think back very far about what is going on around us. I mean, the SARS issue comes immediately to mind, and we think this is a very useful mechanism to deal with issues like that if it became the level of impending health crisis that would warrant this kind of action.
Senator Burdick.
Oh, okay, thank you. You mentioned the SARS epidemic, and that actually is a good example, because one of the things I've observed about the SARS epidemic is, at least in China, you might have 50 deaths, and in a country of, I mean, I forget how many billions of people are in China, and yet you have massive quarantines and things that I would not be comfortable with. What kind of checks and balances are there against involuntary quarantines and that type of thing? People panic, and I just want to make sure that people's civil liberties don't get compromised right in an atmosphere of panic.
Chair Fisher, Senator Burdick, first let me say just on SARS, I mean, we are nowhere close with SARS right now to being what I would consider an impending public health crisis. However, on the other hand, if we had raging epidemics going in both Seattle and San Francisco, I think we would consider, do we need some additional authorities to be able to protect the citizens of Oregon? The issue of protecting civil liberties did come up before, and we worked very closely with the American Civil Liberties Unit Union here in Oregon, that chapter on this. Really, the only thing that has changed in the isolation and quarantine portion of this law is that we would have the ability to temporarily restrict movement of individuals while we provided education to them and got contact information. So again, in the case of SARS, if planes were coming in from an area that had a raging epidemic going, we would then have the authority to provide health education, to get the contact information so that if someone on that plane did in fact have SARS, we would be able to get back to those people. And we did take ACLU's suggestions into consideration in crafting that so that it would be as least restrictive as possible.
In addition, the bill provides for two 14-day periods for an impending crisis declaration. And if it really did, if we really had a circumstance where something really, as I think was said, raging, the governor, under his own constitutional authority, could declare a state of emergency, and there are much broader extensive powers under that ability. So this is a kind of the second step in a process to something that might be quite significant.
And Chair Fisher, Senator Burdick, if I could add to, when the ACLU was working with us on this issue, they went to the national organization and had them review Oregon's isolation and quarantine statute. And actually, it was reported to us that in regards to due process and civil liberties protection, that Oregon actually has one of the better laws in the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Morissette.
I think they spoke to everything that I was going to.
Oh, okay. You folks are the only two that signed up on this particular bill, but I see we do have some civil liberties folks here. Do you wish to register or weigh in? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would take that negative nod to mean that if they had objections, they would stand up and scream, knowing these particular civil liberties.
I was going to say,
I don't have my...
It's been my... My observation that they aren't slack to come up if they feel they've got a...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't have my wallet or I take my ACLU card out. I'm now a card-carrying member, so I feel okay.
Mr. Chair, after recent developments...
You just made your last motion in my committee, Senator Morrison.
Mr. Chair,
let me switch from a public hearing to a work session. Is that proper?
Yeah.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2251 and open a public or a work session on House Bill 2251. Senator Morissette.
I would move House Bill 2251 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation, to the floor of the Senate.
Senator Morissette moves House Bill 2251 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries. Do we have a bill carrier? Do you want to do that, Senator Starr? Thank you very much. Senator Starr will carry House Bill 2251.
You can hold my card.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 891.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 891, as it was printed, modified the licensing qualifications for physical therapists and physical therapist assistants. However, we have the -7 amendment that was requested by Mr. Kifori and the -9 based on request from the chair.
Okay. Mr. Kifori and is it Ricky?
Ricky.
Oh, Sussex.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kifori. I represent the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And before I testify, I'd like to extend my personal thanks to both the chair and the committee administrator. This has been a long saga and has not been easy. We've been, this is, you see, the -7 and -9 amendments before you. This is late in the session for a bill coming out of the original House, and I appreciate your assistance in making that possible. As you heard, the bill originally, as you may recall, was a long bill having to do with a total revision of the Licensing Act for physical therapists. Because it's late in the session, because of people's concerns about what was in that bill, we have stripped it down to one simple issue in our -7 amendments. And that one issue is the elimination of the 30-day requirement. To refresh your many memories, in 1993, this legislature passed a bill eliminating the prior requirement that before a patient could see a physical therapist, they had to have a referral from a medical practitioner. There was a long list of other kinds of people besides MDs that could give that kind of referral. Mm-hmm. And that list has accumulated over the years. part of the compromise in getting that bill passed was the requirement that the direct access could only last for 30 days, and after 30 days, the patient would need to be referred back to one of these nurse practitioner, or chiropractor, or there's a long list of medical doctor list of people. The problem with that has shown in the intervening 10 years is that if a person has a treatment that needs to last longer than 30 days, to interrupt that treatment in the middle of that period of time, suppose they have a 5-week or a 6-week treatment, and then go see a doctor or another a dentist or a chiropractor, that interrupts that treatment in physical therapy. Often it's important that the course of treatment be carried on in a regularized scheme, so that was harming patients' health. The other problem was that there's an additional cost to the health insurance industry and to the patient if they had to go see get a referral, and that the referral would be a pro forma referral, go to the doctor. The doctor said, yeah, I'd go back to see the physical therapist again. Nothing was produced except a cost from this. That's what we have in the Dash 7 amendments. The only other thing besides we eliminated some superfluous language, as you can see, that wouldn't be in effect anymore if we don't have the 30 days. And then because we were concerned about the issue of insurance, which had been raised by the chair, we wanted to make it very clear that this is a Physical Therapy Licensing Practice Act. This is not an insurance act. It's not part of the insurance code, and we don't think it should have anything to do with insurance. The issue of whether a patient is paid for a visit to the physical, excuse me, whether a physical therapist is paid for a visit should be purely a matter between that insurance company and the patient. Insurance policies vary enormously. Blue Cross Blue Shield or these other big companies do not just have one standard policy. They have hundreds of different kinds of policies, and they vary a lot. Some of them provide for direct access. Some of them require that a patient has to see a physician before they can get physical therapy. We have no complaints about that. That is purely a matter, as we say, between the patient and the insurance company and should not be in the licensing act. The Dash 9s also allow direct access, but they only allow direct access in one case, and that is if there's a private pay patient. So if the patient has insurance, this would prohibit the insurance company from paying insurance to a person, even if they paid their, after 30 days, even if they've paid their premiums, that if they saw somebody, if they saw or they were seen for more than 30 days, they could not submit a bill. And it's our contention, although we think this Dash bill, the Dash 9, is preferable to the present act, we strongly would support the Dash 7s because we think it's improper to have this kind of restriction in the Licensing Act, and we think it's improper for the state of Oregon to restrict the contractual relationship between a patient and the insurance company. If the insurance company wants to put limitations on, that's just fine with us. We have no problem with that. We just don't think the state of Oregon and the Licensing Act should put those limitations. Did you have anything to say?
I'm Ricky Sussick, and I'm representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I gave you a little pamphlet or packet here that has more stuff than you probably really want to look at right now. But if you could look at the fifth page, when they talk about should you support direct access legislation, and it basically says in that second paragraph that we did a study in 1994, and it actually shows that when we get referrals from physicians, you actually have more visits and more costs related to physical therapy. Somehow, I think this Dash 9 is the insurance companies, I guess they're afraid that somehow that the physical therapist will run amok after 30 days and just continue to see patients whether they need it or not. Again, I don't think that that's the case, that we don't usually operate that way, but we also know that we have to do...
Which page are you referring to? It's page 5.
I'm sorry. It says, should you support direct access legislation? It's the first fifth sheet in this. I think they aren't numbered. But I guess really what we want to say is that we as physical therapists know that the insurance company, if they're going to pay the bill, they make the rules about what they're going to pay for. And we don't question that at all. And right now, we look at every insurance company that when a patient comes, we have to find out, will they pay for 6 visits? Will they pay for 20 visits? Will they pay for, you know, 30 days? Will they, do they allow to pay for direct access, or do they require a physician referral up front? We have to know that about every insurance company. So, again, the insurance company can certainly, you know, Regents or ODS or anybody can say, okay, we'll pay for direct access for 30 days. They can make that rule, and we're happy for them if they want to make that rule that they can do it. Again, I hesitate to put that kind of stuff in a law because really it doesn't allow the insurance company then to make whatever rules they want because if there's an insurance company rule in there, and we don't want to mandate what insurance companies should do. And so the bottom line is that dash 7 is what we would like to have, basically to say that we can have direct access, which we've had for 12 years, that there's no limit on it, but that insurance doesn't have to pay for it if they don't want it, you know, and they can make their rules. Dash 9 just puts an additional burden, I think. Bad form.
That's yours.
I'm sorry. I was trying to ignore it and keep talking like I wasn't being rude and didn't turn off my pager. I'm sorry. Anyway, and I also want to apologize for the craziness of this whole thing that we've had. We had no intention, nor did we expect this bill in its original form to cause the brouhaha that it did. And so we're going to take the intervening time to look at the bigger bill that we had in the beginning. But in the meantime, we'd really like to look at this Dash 7 amendment. Thank you.
On the Dash 9s, how do you figure that it won't allow an insurance company to go ahead and provide more than 30 days of care?
Mr. Chair, it will allow them to provide more than 30 days of care, but only if you go back and see a doctor first. Because if you read the lines 16 through 19, it says that you can, notwithstanding such and such, the licensed physical therapy may continue administering physical therapy, but if a claim has been submitted for payment, then you can't.
It says at the 31st day you can't ask the insurance company to pay anymore unless basically you get a referral, is what it's saying. So
this limits the ability of an insurance company to draft a contract with a patient that says we will pay for 7 weeks of physical therapy, or we will put no time limit, but we'll put a dollar limit on, or we'll put a number of visits limit on. It doesn't allow that flexibility. It says you must have a 30-day limit.
And for an example, if you have someone who's had a stroke or something, sometimes we'll see them once a week, you know, for 6 visits, and then we'll see them once a month for a couple as they get better and do things. And this just puts all kinds of strange, arbitrary limits that don't really make much sense.
Okay, questions? Don't have a question, Mr. Chair. I have a comment I'd like to make. I suffered an injury to my lower back through excessive lifting when I was 24 years of age. I was referred to Orthopedic Hospital in Norbrück, Germany, and the military wanted me to accede to their wishes to be returned to the States for surgery. I chose not to do that. On the advice of a physical therapist,
I hope it was all right.
I got some board to put under my bed so it was firm, and I got over the sciatic pain that caused me great discomfort. But over the years, for 21 years, I suffered recurring bouts with that problem, and finally was referred by an orthopedic surgeon to a physical therapist to try natural healing rather than surgery. And in 3 visits, I was taught that my stomach muscles was my back support, and in 3 weeks' time, I had become free of excruciating pain.
and have for now 25 years been free of back pain because I maintain strong abdominal muscles. And I want to thank the physical therapist for that, and I believe this is a good bill. At least it goes part of the way where I would go, and I would urge that we pass it with the Dash 7 amendments.
I'm going to downsize the committee to a subcommittee status. We have only three members with us here, but we can continue to take testimony. Further questions? Thank you very much. We'll call Peggy Annett, John Powell, and Lynn Hagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. I also represent Regents, and Lynn Hagen is here to address those concerns. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to call the committee's attention to an area of the law that is a little bit complex, but very meaningful in the context of this discussion. The Dash 7 amendments would allow someone to be in an automobile accident, go directly to a physical therapist, and be treated there for the full year that PIP benefits are in force without seeing a physician. And that's done because of a peculiar nature of the automobile insurance laws. Under Oregon's PIP law, the policy provisions are prescribed by statute. We can't modify those by contract. So the PIP law would remain in effect. If you look at page 2 of the Dash 7 amendments on line 26, you'll see that that statute specifically says that in personal injury protection in the insurance code, which is a different code, under the PIP laws, benefits are not required to be paid for physical therapy treatment of a person covered by the applicable insurance policy unless the person is referred to the physical therapist by a licensed physician. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the reason for that prescription in this statute is because the insurance code prescribes the benefits and prevents us from putting contractual limitations on physical therapy in this case. So we rely upon the referral from a physician because we believe that the best medical care should come from a thorough look at this person and not just one symptom that this person may be having. So for that reason, we cannot agree with the Dash 7 amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I have objected to the former proposals related to the physical therapy scope of practice changes. And during the course of this, Senator Fisher had asked us to take a look at a proposal that would allow a person on a self-pay basis to continue without impeding insurance contract types of provisions. At least in terms of the companies that I represent, there has not been there's not been any call for a change in terms of the current provisions in statute. However, at Senator Fisher's request, we came up with some language that allows the insurance provisions to continue, as well as allowing an individual who wants to self-pay after 30 days to continue to do so. I personally don't have a problem with the existing statute. statute, absent any amendments at all. But again, at the request of Senator Fisher, we sat down and addressed what we thought was a specific issue that related to those individuals who wanted on a self-pay basis to continue beyond the 30 days. If they want to go back under the guise of their insurance policy and have a referral, they will be able to continue to get extended coverage and thereby extend their benefits. If they don't want to go back, they would be able to, on a self-pay basis, receive the services of a physical therapist. And the final comment that I would make is that part of these discussions relate to the insurance. The other half of the discussion, which we have not addressed, is the question about the merits of periodic oversight of physical therapy services. And I think there are still some outstanding issues on that, but that was not what Senator Fisher asked us to address. Thank you.
Go ahead, Lauren. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Leonard Hagan with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Like Peggy Annett has already testified to, Regents has also objected to previous proposals, but we were also asked to work on language accomplishing the two objectives that Peggy mentioned, and that is to remove the 30-day referral requirement for private pay patients. So private pay patients, if they wanted to see a physical therapist for an infinite number of days, visits, it doesn't matter if they're private pay. The other objective was to retain the existing statute for insurers. We believe that the Dash 9 amendments do accomplish that. There was a comment that the Dash 9 amendments would prohibit insurers, I think, from paying past 30 days on a direct access basis. Regents right now for our HMO products, we do have a referral requirement. For our traditional policies, we do not. So in essence, a direct access. The Dash 9 amendments would not prohibit us from covering somebody past 30 days. All it says is that if you're going to bill an insurer, you default to the statute as it exists today. And that is, you go back to a physician and get a referral. We would continue providing the visits. So for insurance, it truly retains the statute in its current form. The Dash 7 amendments, I don't believe they do retain for insurance purposes the statute in its current form. The provision that was recited earlier on page 2, section 2, lines 26 to 30, carrying over onto page 3, what that provision, or the bill does, is the bill removes the 30-day requirement, and then in that section that I just noted, it's really what it says in a positive term is that there is coverage unless a referral is required. And because we don't require referrals for our traditional products, we think that could increase utilization and require us to amend or to go in and make some contract changes that we don't have to do under the Dash 9s.
Another gentleman came up with you. Did he you wish to testify?
Mr. Chairman, he is an attorney with State Farm Insurance and was advising me because I'm glad he was here because he helped me understand the problem with that section as it relates to auto insurance. As Mr. Hagan pointed out, Regents could amend their contract. We would have to get a bill introduced to amend our contract.
The final comment is, as Peggy mentioned, we're not looking for a change to the current statute.
Questions?
Where do we go from here?
Well, I want to ask Steve Kapori and
how we don't have
Ricky Sussick to come up and weigh in on this particular issue as it's been raised.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we talked extensively during this earlier part of the committee
outside in the hallway, the insurance people and we. And I think what we've come to, as I understand, there's the situation is that the insurance companies are concerned that if the Dash 7s pass, they would have to change their policies. They would literally have to go in and make new contracts because their contracts now are written in, according to the present statute. I think that's the main difference between the insurance companies and
my understanding is that the PIP can't change their contracts. That's the law.
Well, I asked legislative counsel Charlie Cheek to draft subsection 2 of section 2 with these very explicit directions. I said, would you please draft that section so that it has, this bill will have no impact on PIP coverage. He's the expert, I'm not. Our understanding, the whole thing on our reason for putting in section 2, sub 2, was to say there's a distinction between the insurance codes and the licensing practice acts. And there should not be anything in the License Practice Act that restricts how insurance companies act. Now, I thought back when this PIP coverage provision was first put in 1993 that there was no need for it at that time. It was purely a feel-good provision because if you read 742.520 through 742.542, the PIP statutes, all they say is that if somebody is injured, they're going to get coverage. And benefits would pay to take care of them. It doesn't say anything about 30 days or which kind of person is going to provide it, whether it's going to be an acupuncturist or a naturopath or a physical therapist or an MD. It just says that there will be coverage, will be covered. So my understanding in 1993 was that this was put in by the PIP people because it made them feel good, that it didn't actually change the status of the law, that the requirements in 742.520 would take place regardless of whether this section was in or not. Now, I haven't had an opportunity to meet with the lawyer, and I don't know his concerns, but I don't think that this section, how you word it, makes any difference, Mr. Chair, in the law. I don't think you need to have that section. It's a feel-good section to make the insurance companies feel that they were concerned somehow with someone say, well, we got direct access, now insurance companies have to pay. That's not our intent. It doesn't say that in the law. We don't think it's necessary to put anything in the law that says insurance companies don't have to pay. We think that's covered under the insurance statutes and by common law and by the of contract.
If you look at our current statute, which is what we basically went back to, minus the 30 days and saying that insurance doesn't have to pay, it's right in there that says that PIP has always been exempt from the direct access rules, as are a couple other people like therapists working in schools and in nursing homes. So there was a few people, and work comp was exempt from that. And that's still the case. So in our head, that isn't what that means there. All we wanted to do was say, take away the 30 days and say insurance doesn't have to pay. Everything else would stay the same. And
there is no exemption, no specific exemption in our law about workers' comp. Now, if the workers' comp attorneys had come in and said, we're worried about this, is going to make you pay for workers' comp, we would have put in a section that says workers' comp. That's why this is. It doesn't.
It's covered under a whole new.
Right, there is a section in our law that
exactly
says workers' comp is exempt.
Exactly.
It's in
but
our
that's,
current law.
That's why 742 is in here. 742.2520 to 742.542 is the PIP statute. And the reason we put this in, we put in is at the request of the PIP coverers 10 years ago because they felt that they didn't want the statute to be misinterpreted. They didn't want the statute, anybody read the statute and say, aha, because you've got 30 days, or because you've got direct access, now we have to pay in 30 days access. Excuse me, on direct access. It's an irrelevant nicety to put in there. It doesn't make any difference legally. So how it's worded or not is irrelevant.
Can we get Charlie Cheek in here?
Yes, we can.
So are we going to have a quorum?
We will have a quorum if we get to the point that we're ready to go, because I'm not going to go ahead with this on a basis of
of my judgment. I've got to have some other people that are in here that are competent to do this. And Charlie drew this -7, and I want him to explain the basis here, because we have a direct conflict of testimony.
I thought we were just getting ready for the next 05 session here.
I have till 3 o'clock for my last committee meeting. Now, don't short me too much.
Oh, no.
At least 15 minutes here. I got to go.
You got to go 15 minutes. And then we'll have to fill in the person who's not here so we're sure they understand what's going on, right?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, I already took care of that.
Oh, you did. Okay.
And we may get Senator Clarno back by that time, so we should still be.
So we're going to meet tomorrow.
So do you want us to go or stay?
Well, just stay here available if you don't mind.
No, I want to stay here. I don't know if you want me to stay up here. You want to talk to the other lawyer.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You're fine there. We don't have any protocol.
So we won't be
this until further notice.
Well, we do.
Yes, I should have put it in recess until we can get. So we're in full committee status, and we're in a public hearing on Senate Bill 891.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Stephen Gaffori, representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. Because it's late in the session, and this is your last committee meeting, I think the most prudent thing to do would be to pass the -9s out. We will continue the debate on this issue in the House, and perhaps not, depending on what the House wants to do, come back with an amended bill that we can talk about concurrence at that point.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I would move the -9.
Oh, wait, we've got to get... Thank you. I will close public hearing on Senate Bill 891 and open a work session on Senate Bill 891.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I move the -9 amendments to Senate Bill 891.
Senator Brown has moved the -9 amendments to Senate Bill 891. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Clarno.
Senator Clarno is excused along with Senator Burdick.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 891 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 891 to the Senate floor with a due as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Chair Fisher.
Aye. The motion carries. I will carry it now. I want to thank my committee
for their help and concern during the session. Since this is our last meeting, and I'll have to make that to two-thirds today and the other third personally here in the next day or so. So thank you very much for the help and the work that you've accomplished here for the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, we will be adjourned for the session.
It's been great fun.